used to love it. I think I still love comedy, but my back hurts. I'm tired. I've been in this car too long.
Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Chris Gethard is a stand-up comedian, actor, writer, and podcast host. His new special, Chris Gethard, Half My Life, is available now. Directed by Kate Sweeney and produced by Lexi Tannenholtz, Chris Gethard, Half My Life is a hybrid tour documentary and stand-up special shot in a variety of DIY spaces and independent venues all over the country in 2019. It was released earlier this month by Comedy Dynamics.
I asked my dad his opinion on this. My dad has a PhD in environmental science. He got it right when he retired. So he's kind of built to answer this question. So I go to him, I go, Dad, I live in New York City now. Apocalypse hits, what do I do? And he answered instantly. He didn't stop and think about it for even 1 second. I go, New York City, apocalypse hits, what do I do? He goes, follow the rats. And I'm like, excuse me? And he goes, rats are survivors, man. They'll be going somewhere. You go there too, maybe you'll be a survivor too. You follow those rats. And I was like, dude, I've known you for 39 years. This is the first cool thing you have ever said. That's awesome. Follow the rats, that's the best. That's like my new life mantra. I will follow the rats anywhere until, of course, the rats go down some alley that's a dead end where there's a 1-inch gap in the brick that they can squeeze through because they're rats. And then my glasses fall off and I die.
Gethard's previous special, Career Suicide, is on HBO. As an actor, he's worked on television on Bored to Death, Parks and Recreation, Broad City, Inside Amy Schumer, Crashing, Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, Space Force, and truly a whole lot more. Film credits include Don't Think Twice, The Dictator, and The Other Guys. The Chris Gethard Show, a call-in comedy and variety talk show, which started as a live show at UCB in New York City, moved to the public access channel Manhattan Neighborhood Network, MNN, and then to cable channels Fusion and then True TV. He returned to public access with a stand-up showcase entitled Chris Gethard Presents. His podcast, Beautiful Anonymous, is on the Earwolf Network. Once again, the new comedy special is Chris Gethard, Half My Life. Chris Gethard, welcome back to The Roundtable.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your new comedy special, Chris Gethard, Half My Life, is available now, as you know. And also, as you know, was filmed in 2019 where you were, for parts of it, it seemed like you were kind of wavering about how much you really liked being on the road anymore. Since you've been doing it for half your life, you have a wife and kid at home. And it seemed like, you know, you might be more comfortable being home with them. And then you were forced to stay home for a year. What are your thoughts about touring now?
I certainly miss it more than I thought I would. Filming it at the end of 2019, I think it's totally valid. Like, I do have a son now. I want to be home more. I am older. I don't have the stamina to be out there like I used to. But one thing I find over and over again, and it was during those shows in 2019, and now that shows have started coming back. When you actually put me in the room, and I'm actually getting to do comedy, connect with people, make eye contact, it's in an intimate space, that never loses its appeal. It's all the stuff surrounding it. It's the travel, it's the logistics, occasional toxicity of the comedy scene itself. It's all those things. But when I actually get to get up, do a show, make people laugh, there's not a better feeling in the world.
I relate to that even as not a touring comedian, but just as a getting older person. I used to be able to like drive home from New York City at 2 a.m. and now I absolutely cannot do that.
Oh, it's really, it's like such a cliche, but I feel like quickly after I turned 40, all of a sudden it was like, oh, my knees hurt all the time and I forget how technology works. It was almost instantaneous.
And you mentioned in the special, you also are feeling new feelings with parenthood and with age too. Could you, I'm not asking you to do your routine, but expound on that a little bit.
I never want to be one of these people who's like, oh my God, you have to have a kid. You don't have to have a kid. I'm totally down if you don't want to. And in fact, you probably are giving yourself a sense of freedom and fun that I will no longer have for the rest of my life. But that being said, I don't think it's too Hallmark card to just say, oh, wow, it's crazy to be 39 when my son is born and to realize, oh, there's human emotions I haven't actually felt yet. And, that whole joke revolves around that idea of there's these things that he does or these ways that I see him see the world. And they hit me in a way that I haven't experienced before, which at the age of 40, I thought I had felt some version of all the feelings, and it turns out I hadn't. And that's one of the great gifts that my son has given me.
You have spent a lot of time thinking about and exploring exactly how you feel or deal with certain things because, and you've been very public about this, you have a struggle with some mental illness challenges, which most of us do, I think. But, you know, you've been very public about it, and your first, your HBO special was all about that, while also being very funny. It always sounds like we're just trying to bring people down, but you're hilarious. Let's make sure everybody knows that.
Thank you. It needs to be mentioned sometimes, yeah.
It must have been very surprising to be like, you can't believe there's still depths to be plumbed and highs to reach.
Oh, for sure. As someone who has maybe dwelled too often on my feelings, I thought I had them mapped out. And I've spent a lot of money, not to mention time, but money, you know, with professionals who help explain feelings to me. So I don't know what I've been paying for. Apparently there were some others they had not yet told me about. But yeah, I was pretty shocked because I am pretty notoriously aware of feelings. I'm not someone who stuffs them very deep down, but yeah, my son Cal, he brought some new ones to the surface. It's been cool.
The comedy special we're talking about, Chris Gethard, Half My Life, it's a comedy special and a tour film. And the comedy, your stand-up sets are filmed at different venues, small clubs, the Colony in Woodstock, New York, which is in our listening area. And it looks like sometimes people's I don't know if they're exactly living room shows, but it looks like you have some people can just book you. I saw it on your website too. People can reach out to a certain person to get you to perform in any kind of weird space. What do you like about making yourself available for those types of rooms?
Well, I think comedy gives me a lot too. You know, it's about the audience. I want it to be about the audience's experience, and I want to give them everything I've got. But at least in my case, can't speak for other comedians, I sit here, I go, when I connect with a crowd and they're laughing and it seems like they can get on the same wavelength as I am about the things I'm talking about, it makes me feel less alone. So I feel like even as my career has grown, I can do spaces that have more tickets than I was able to do 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But I really do prioritize making sure that even if I play some of those larger spaces, I have to play some of these intimate ones too, because I think it gives less to the audience to feel far away. I don't ever want anybody to feel like their role at my show is ticket holder. I don't think that that's a very fun way to spend an evening. I want them to feel like we can connect and that I can see them and they can see me, and that gives them the most. And it also gives me a lot too. So my first show back actually in July, my first show on my tour is literally in someone's backyard. And then there's other shows on that tour where we're doing 400-seat theaters, two shows in a night, where I have to sell 800 tickets. And to me, I go, I love the idea, the challenge of trying to sell 800 tickets in a night. For some comedians, that's nothing, you know? Some comedians can blink their eye and sell 10 times that. Good for them. For me, I like the idea that one night I have to sell almost 1,000 tickets, but then maybe two nights before, it was for 70 people in somebody's backyard. I'm not sure, you know, financially that's pretty self-defeating. It probably would be better spent trying to sell 800 more tickets. But I think sort of spiritually, not to be too cheesy, the backyard barbecue show, that's why I got into this. That's the type of show I would go and see when I was a kid. The second time I ever saw live music, it was my friend's backyard. They had a bunch of bands. So that's what I grew up with. That's what I like. And I want to keep that alive.
Have you ever had that you're willing to tell us about, a strange experience at one of the really small shows?
Oh, 100%. There's so many that come to mind. Here's what I haven't spoken about publicly. I did, years ago, I did a tour of house shows where I advertised, I just want to perform in houses. I was working out new material, and there were a bunch of other comedians on the scene who I felt like were kind of similarly on the wavelength of me, of like non-traditional, and I wanted to get to know them all better. So I said, let's book a bunch of house shows, get in the car, a bunch of us will just drive to people's houses. And two of the people who did these shows were one's a guy named Dan Licata. He's a writer at Saturday Night Live now. He also wrote for Joe Pera's Adult Swim show, and Joe Pera was the other comic. It was me, Dan, and Joe Pera. Mm-hmm. We went and did a show in Ithaca, New York. And if you haven't been watching Joe's Adult Swim show, it's great. It's fantastic and calming and relaxing. But if you know Joe, very, very laid back, mild mannered guy. I am as well. Dan is as well. And we did this show in a basement in Ithaca. And the basement was already kind of set up as a party space. And we were like, this is weird. Because upstairs, this is just a suburban house. Like, we've done some of these punk collectives where, yeah, everybody lives here and they do shows. This looks like a normal house and then the basement. And they had a jacuzzi in the basement. And then after the show went really well. And then after the show, everybody's kind of hanging out. And it became clear that all the people who stayed clearly hang out in this basement all the time. Like, they had a sense of familiarity with it. And then they started filling up the jacuzzi. And then one of the people mentioned to Dan that she... Do you remember there was a fad a bunch of years back where... I don't want to be crass, so I'll watch the language, but it was called vajazzling.
Yes.
Where it would be ornamental adjustments to your pubic area in a bedazzler-like fashion. This woman started talking to Dan about how she had done that. And all of a sudden, it became very clear... This is a swingers hangout. These people are swingers, and this basement is their stomping grounds. And we thought we were doing a comedy show, and let's maybe all gracefully exit to make sure that we just did a comedy show tonight, because I have a feeling there's an after party to this comedy show, and it is not what we signed up for. So we skedaddled. And look, I'm not judging anybody's lifestyle. I'm not one to sex shame or kink shame. It's just, yeah, as we all started to ease into it, we said, okay, this is, the comedy show was the caterpillar. This is becoming a butterfly. And maybe we need to just understand the time to exit. And that time is right now. Let's go.
Right. We're caterpillar guys. Let's stay caterpillars and leave.
Absolutely.
A couple years back, Hallie and I went on a vacation. We went to Orlando, Florida. And we went to Disney World, because that's what you do, right? When you go to Orlando, you go to Disney World. But both of us had been to Disney World before, so we didn't want to spend our whole vacation there. And that led to us saying something that does not always end well. We said, let's see what else Orlando has to offer. And that's how we discovered a place called Gatorland. Yeah. Anybody been?
I saw you open for Mike Birbiglia at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall in 2014. He was, I think, working up the Thank God for Jokes show at that point. And you told your Gatorland section, and I love it. I've thought about it a lot since then. Almost any time I hear Gator, I think Chris Gethard. And then I was so psyched to see it again in this special. What do you want to tell us that we can't get from the stand-up about Gatorland and your relationship now to the park in Orlando?
Gatorland is an incredible place. First of all, thank you. Glad you dug the joke. It's also cool that you know I've been working on that joke for 8 years. Like, it's really put in the time on it. The joke really boils down Gatorland to its crazy elements. And I want to be clear, there are many, and it is not a lie. But one thing I will say is, A, there's other aspects to Gatorland, like how a lot of the animals that at their park would have been euthanized if they hadn't taken them. Things like that. That's a very good-hearted thing. Conservation, education. And the other thing I just want to say is thank you, Gatorland, for having such a good sense of humor. When they found out about the joke, it was not my doing, and I was very scared they were going to be upset. And instead, they really got on board quick. I think that they take a lot of pride in being a less corporate entity. And, you know, the whole joke's a comparison about the corporate side of Disney with the lawless side of Gatorland. And I think they were able to see which parts were the jokes and also see that there was actually a lot of admiration from me and the idea of sometimes it's best to kind of just let your guard down and go with the place that is rough around the edges. There's joy in that. There's something to those places you don't get elsewhere. And it's worth hanging on to. So I think they had a really good sense of humor and were able to kind of see that at the heart of the joke, I was an admirer, even though I was also slamming the fact that they just hand you turkey hot dogs and you can throw them at alligators, not even in a pre-assigned area. So kudos to them for rolling with the punch and enjoying the funny parts.
Yeah, I really felt like, I mean, your tone was such that you were celebrating Gatorland, basically, throughout. I mean, there's not a lot of, like, it doesn't seem like you're being very derisive at all.
And I have real love for, like, that old roadside Americana, like, the old Route 66 stuff that's still there. Like, Florida alone, I could do a whole other bit about the Coral Castle. I could do another bit about the Weekiwachi Mermaid Park. Like, that's just Florida. I love the roadside, that stuff from car culture that's still standing because some driven maniac had an idea to make money and they're sticking with it. I think there's something very romantic about that idea and very worth holding on to, even though it leads to a lot of craziness at times.
Are you scared of alligators?
Oh, immensely. I think that showed in the throughout the course of the special. Yeah. Yes, I would say more scared now than I was before I filmed this even.
You are also a podcast host. You host Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People, beautiful/anonymous sort of for short. You've been doing that for a number of years now. The rules of the podcast, for those who don't know, are you put out that here's the number, call, don't tell me your name, and you as the host can't hang up first. If they get uncomfortable, the anonymous guest can hang up, but you're not allowed. You have to keep talking to them, and that's the rule you've made for yourself, the rule of the podcast. You have discovered some truly beautiful stories over the years. Do you stay connected to any of the people who are anonymous on the show, or do they stay anonymous forever to you?
It's a great question. We've done, I think we're coming up close to 300 episodes now. There's been a handful who I've met in real life, and then out of that handful, a few who I've stayed connected with. The two that jump out as the most connected, one is very funny. We had an extraordinarily charming call from a 39-year-old grandma. I believe that was also the title of the episode. And she just explained she had a kid young. Her kid had a kid young. Now she's 39. She's a grandmother. And she was just like so joyous and full of life. And the fans of the show loved her. And every time I'm in her area and I perform live, she shows up. And we've actually gotten to know each other just in passing through that, and it's a lovely thing, and I am a big fan of hers. And then there's another call, probably the most impactful call the show's done, I think a lot of the fans would say, where it was called Love is Everywhere. And it was a mother who was calling from a hospital where she was in the waiting room while her daughter was undergoing some tests in relation to a very rare type of cancer. It was a very, very sad call. It was beautiful. It was so heartbreaking, but it was also so uplifting. And the phrase Love is Everywhere was the title.
In fact, I have to tell you, my daughter, the very first week we were in the hospital, this is still 8-year-old, had this big list on the whiteboard of all the things that she had to go through that week. Because when they first get diagnosed, they have to get all kinds of tests done to them. So she had this big list. And she also, on the whiteboard, there were people had written notes. We love Holly and, you know, get better, just little cute notes on it. And then she wrote totally at a time. I didn't even know. I don't even know when she did it, but I looked over at one point and then she'd written Love is Everywhere on the board. And that's just become our mantra and helped us. She writes it everywhere and people, it's just her elementary school made a big on along the fence, tied these pink ribbons and says Love is Everywhere. So it's really amazing, the community support and love. So
wow,
not all bad.
I'm gonna call,
a lot of hard, but not all bad.
I'm gonna say, I've been doing this show for well over a year. I haven't cried yet, and this one's gonna get me. I can feel it already. I can feel it already. Love is Everywhere is already it's gonna get me.
Yeah, there's a lot of good in this world, and it's good to remember that.
Since then, her daughter has sadly passed away, and we've done some follow-up calls, and now she runs an organization called Holly's Miracles to raise money in name of her daughter. So I've stayed in touch with her, and actually even beyond just like helping to, you know, wanting to contribute money on my own and spread word about it to our fan base, I actually will say, even when I had my son, I followed up with her and said, you know, your call really ripped my heart out when it happened, and now I understand it on an even deeper level. And I've met her in person too. Sorry, I'm rambling. You can tell. It makes me a little emotional.
Yes, no, of course. Where do you think, if you can sort of self-analyze, your ability to talk to anyone about anything, which I am saying you do have that ability, like you don't have to claim it for yourself, I'm bestowing it upon you. Where do you think your comfort with that comes from? How do you remain so curious about people?
Well, thank you. I will say, first off, in real life, I'm dreadfully hard to talk to. And fans of the show it's actually become almost like a meme within the community of the fans of the show that sometimes they'll come up to meet me after a live show. They'll buy a ticket and they'll try to talk to me, and it will be so uncomfortable that they will then make fun of me online for it, playfully. So I'm not great at it in real life. I think creatively, I have built a lot of work that is really clamoring to connect with people. And I think the sad answer is I have felt an immense amount of loneliness in my life. I am a textbook person who can be at a party where it's wall-to-wall people and I can feel terrifically alone. Just the other day, I was actually, I did a show with Mike Birbiglia, and I was in the car with him and another friend, and I was in the back seat. And this is Mike Birbiglia. He's been a great friend to me for 10 years, a mentor of mine. I'm sitting in the back seat and these guys are talking, and I'm sitting in the back in my head going, should I jump in? Well, they were talking about basketball, but that was 3 or 4 minutes ago. But I had a thing to say about that. Is it going to be weird if I bring up basketball now? I'm like, my inability to participate in a 3-person conversation with friends who I know well, I'm crippled. I'm emotionally crippled in the backseat trying to think of it. So I think I like building some projects that are about talking and connecting, because for the large majority of my life, I have found that to be an incredibly hard thing to do on my own. So it's nice to build some infrastructure that encourages it. And I think it makes the callers really trust me, because they know they do not need to be nervous. They're not being judged. I am in no rush. If they misspeak or they're nervous or there's 5 or 6 minutes that are boring, I got your back, because that's me too. We're not going to cut anything out and boil it down. We're not going to coach you. There's no pre-interview. Just be yourself. I understand how hard it can be to be yourself. So just go do that.
Before you start recording Beautiful Anonymous, are you nervous? Are you excited? How do you feel before you start recording? I imagine it varies from day to day, but generally speaking.
I would say in general, I actually get very, very calm. I really look forward to it. There's this really nice period between when I send the phone number out on social media, and then people are calling, and my producers will talk to a bunch of people. They really don't pre-screen much. They make sure it doesn't sound like the person's in a wind tunnel, which, as you know, sometimes you get a connection with someone remotely, you go, oh, this is unusable audio. So that would be a waste of everybody's time. So if it's not going to work, like, oh, you're calling from the Autobahn in Germany and there's rumble strips? Yeah, we can't do that. Sorry. It sounds like a fascinating place to talk, but can't have just the whole call. And then they just make sure, okay, you know, we've had a bunch of calls about topic X lately, and this one is that. So they do that. And in that process, which takes about 5 minutes, that 5 minutes for me is just so pleasant, because I get to just shut out the rest of the world, and I get to just sit there with my cup of tea, and I get to remember that for an hour, I just get to hear about someone else's life. And it certainly takes some work, and I've learned that there's some skills to it, and at times it can be very tough if the calls are emotionally hard, but I feel like, man, I have somehow pulled off this magic trick where my job is that I get to just talk with a human being and hear what they have to say. So I always really treasure that stretch right before the call. It's only when we're like 20 minutes in and I'm screwing everything up, that's when I start to panic.
I feel similarly about my job when I get to talk to comedians that I like. And on my weekend, my interview prep for the week is to watch a wonderful comedy special to laugh and feel and care. And so, Chris Gethard, thank you for making my job enjoyable.
Oh, that's so nice. What a kind thing to say. Thank you.
Well, it's true. I also wanted to say, I've just been thinking about this since you said it. Sitting in the back seat of a car when two people are in the front is a hard conversation dynamic because you can't hear them as well as they can hear each other. And then you yell from the back seat so they can hear you. It's a mess. It's hard for a lot of people to talk to two people in the front of the car.
And I think there's probably all these, socially, we're all trained. Like usually you're back there as a little kid and your parents just want you to shut up. So you probably, I probably have that in my, all these childhood associations of like, no, I'm a backseat person today. I should be seen and not heard. There's probably all sorts of stuff tied up into it that I need to pay my shrink to sort out.
Or ask Cal about it.
Yeah, or that. Or when he develops enough language, he can crack the code.
Chris Gethard's new special, Chris Gethard, Half My Life, is released from Comedy Dynamics. It's available most places you watch things. Of course, more information available at chrisgeth.com, chrisgeth.com. Chris Gethard, thank you again for your time and have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You too.
This nurse walks into the room. She goes, I've been delivering babies in this hospital for 33 years. There's a lot of things that are gonna happen that are gonna make you wanna freak out. I'm gonna tell you everything you need to know so you don't freak out. And then she went, and talked for 2 straight hours.
Chris Gethard, Half My Life, is available from Comedy Dynamics. Links to more information will be posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.